Thank you very much. We're going to be discussing tonight what I call Introduction to Kabbalah, or what is Kabbalah and what is not Kabbalah. Surprisingly enough, the Oxford Dictionary translates something correctly here. Usually, people call Kabbalah mysticism, and mysticism actually is a fairly decent translation of what we mean when we say Kabbalah. According to the Oxford Dictionary, it means that which is spiritually allegorical. Because, first and foremost, Judaism sees the physical world as an expression of a deeper spiritual world. Anything in the physical world is not only a symbol, but it's actually a physical manifestation of a deeper spiritual idea. Which means when we talk about Kabbalah, what we're actually doing is talking about the connection between that physical idea, or the physical essence, and the spiritual idea which is behind that physical evidence. Spiritually allegorical. Occult and esoteric. That means it's hidden. Yes, it is hidden. It's hidden for a number of reasons. First of all, it is hidden because of the fact that it's not immediately obvious. It's not the type of thing that you can pick up just by seeing, by observation. It's not the type of thing you can figure out from first principles. It is something which is, to a great degree, hidden. It is also hidden, for a second reason, we'll discuss that, by halakha, by Jewish law, which actually has certain limitations on what by my study. We'll discuss why that is later, although I should point out for all those who are worried, I discussed with Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Hillel, one of the great Kabbalists of our day, and he said anything in my class is definitely fine. Right? I think he put that, said that as a put down, but anyway, nevertheless, everything in my class is fine. Right, so, and it's hidden meaning, mysterious and awe-inspiring, which I think is true of much of the Kabbalah. So that's what we mean when we say mysticism. However, in the Hebrew language, Kabbalah actually means, lekabel means to receive. So the Kabbalah is really that which is received. Now, in fact, we know that the whole Torah is a matter of receiving. Why Kabbalah, the particular spiritual component of the Torah, is called receiving more than any other part, is because, as Nachmanides says, there are certain things, Kabbalah can only be understood if you actually have a tradition, person to person, all the way back to Moses, of blessed memory. What that means is, it is something which has to be received. There are certain parts of the Torah you can figure out. A lot of the financial laws of the Torah, if you have certain principles, you can figure the whole thing out. There are other aspects of the Torah which you might be able to figure out from observation. However, the Kabbalah is something which requires receiving. It also means Kabbalah because you have to be receptive to it. There are certain people, probably the majority of the world's population, who are totally not receptive to this. You start talking to them about spirituality, their eyes glaze over and they look for the nearest beer. Right? That is not someone, the type of person, right, whose concept of spiritual is getting their car selected by MTV for Pimp My Wheels, right, is not a type of person you can speak to about Kabbalah. You start talking to them about the soul, and they're thinking about how many horsepower is that, man? Right? I mean, it's like, you know, we're not on the same wavelength as most of those people. In order to actually receive, you've got to be a Mekabel. The fact of the matter is, to receive anything spiritual, you've got to be a Mekabel, a receiver. You've got to be someone who is open to the idea, someone who is totally embedded in the material world, who's you know, the couch, the cable, the beer, the pizza, that's it, right? That's not a person who is a Mekabel, who is a receiver. All he can receive is 24-hour weather and other stuff like that, right? Now, in Hebrew, Kabbalah is also known as Sod. The word Sod means secret, or Sitrei Torah, secrets of the Torah. Now, how do we normally understand the word secret as being that which, when someone tells me, by the way, this is a secret, that means the next few people I tell, I'll mention to them, by the way, this is confidential. Right? So, now, once I tell a whole bunch of people, is it a secret anymore? It's no longer a secret. There was, in Israel, right, for a long time, everyone knows this, I'm not in danger of revealing anything security-wise, Israel has a nuclear reactor in Dimon. Anyone know that? I mean, just about everyone knows that in Israel. You know, you drive past there, and the tour guide will say, you'll say, oh, what's that? And he'll say, oh, it's nothing. I say, what do you mean it's nothing? There are massive fences all around it. There's a balloon above it with a radar mounted below it. There are crack reconnaissance troops all around doing patrols, and etc. And it's nothing. He says, oh, it's a factory, Osen, something like that. Where they make Bisley, it's top secret. The truth is, there's very high security at Osen, probably as high security as at the nuclear reactor. But in any case, it's not a secret that Israel has a nuclear reactor. Everyone knows it. Yet Kabbalah is called secret no matter how many people might know about it. What's the reason for that? Because in the same way as it's a secret I always refer to by hinting, remez, I hint to it. I never speak about it directly. The Kabbalah is also like that. Why? Because I cannot speak about it directly. Since it is referring to the spiritual world, I can only use physical metaphors, physical examples, physical allegory. And therefore, I'm never speaking about it directly. I'm always like alluding to it. If I'm always alluding to it, it always remains on the level of what they call in Italian sottovoce, which is, you know, some voice, right? Something which not omerta, that's Sicilian, right? But something a little above omerta, between sottovoce and omerta. For those who are familiar with The Sopranos, you'll understand. But in any case, there is the idea that it's always alluded to, hinted at. It's never spoken about directly. That's one of the reasons I should point out why, according to many of our sages, the Olam Haba, the world to come, and the idea of life after death is not mentioned in the five books. It's not mentioned in the Chumash. Read through the Torah. Nowhere in the Torah does it mention the life after death, the world to come. Why is that? There's many reasons. There's 12 answers that I have found in the Rishonim. But one of them, I'll tell you, is a very interesting answer. He says, it's Ibn Ezra. He says, look, when you speak about the world to come, that's the spiritual life. He says, can we have any vocabulary that will actually describe the spiritual life? Of course not. We only have vocabulary which is physical. So, in order to describe a spiritual existence, what will we have to do? Use physical examples. He says, now, if you start talking about it using physical examples, what will happen? Will we elevate our own perception to the extent where we understand it as spiritual, or will we drag down Olam Haba to the extent where we look at it as physical? What do you think will happen? I think the latter will happen. We'll drag it down. Isn't this what happened in many religions? There are many religions where they talked a lot about the world to come and life after death and etc., etc., etc. And since they talked about it a lot, they had to use physical examples to describe what it is. People did not elevate themselves above the physical and think of it as spiritual. You know what they did? They dragged it down to the physical and started thinking of it as some type of Club Med, but it's in heaven. You know, that's how they looked at it. The Jewish understanding is there are 72 caterers up there. Right, that's how, but that would be how many people would understand it, right? So, but the idea here is that we are always, we so to speak, don't want to drag the spiritual down to the physical, so the Torah doesn't even talk about that idea. So therefore, that's why Kabbalah is called, amongst other things, is called in English mysticism, in Hebrew it's called Kabbalah, and it's called Sod or Sitrei Torah. Now, what is not Kabbalah? What's not Kabbalah? Is, there's Esther there, for those who are familiar with her. What's not Kabbalah is holy water, red threads, celebrity endorsements, drumming and sweat lodges. These are all things which, by the way, people in Hollywood believe are Kabbalah. Right? Relaxation techniques, rock videos and tattoos. I mentioned before Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Hillel. Anyone heard of Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Hillel? Put up your hands. Anyone's heard of him? Not a lot of people. Okay. Now, you know why that is? Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Hillel is probably the greatest Kabbalist in the world today. The reason most of you have not heard of him is because A, he has no website. B, he has no celebrity endorsements. C, he has never been on Oprah, and God forbid he never will be. Right? And so you've never heard of him. That does not make him not a Kabbalist. Many ideas, but you see, relaxation. I have a friend, David Aaron, who has had the dubious merit of teaching a number of celebrities Kabbalah. So one of them who asked him to teach her was Goldie Hawn. Goldie Hawn, Jewish, right, according to the Hanukkah song. So Goldie Hawn, Jewish, and... is that right? No, I think so, yeah. So anyway, so Goldie Hawn, he goes to her house, her palace, or whatever it is, right? And she says, come into this room, and there's a room with cushions thrown all over the floor, right, like mauve wallpaper. There are aromatherapy candles, you know, like lit all around. There is sitar music in the background. Ravi Shankar, Anushka Shankar. Right? And she's just standing, she says, is this spiritual enough, Rabbi? Right? And he's thinking to himself, you know what she means by spiritual? Relaxing. Spirituality is not relaxation. I had a dog for 13 years, Labrador Cocker Spaniel Cross. The most spiritual thing he did was try to become one with the carpet. I mean, that was it. Just try to lose his essence in the carpet. But basically, right, the dog was not spiritual. There was not a spirituality is growth. Spirituality, becoming more spiritual, may actually be painful at certain times. It's challenge, it's growth. It's not relaxation, Right? Going to the Grateful Dead concert may be enjoyable, but it is not spiritual, despite the name. Right? So that is, those are some of the things which are not. The way I would probably want to describe Kabbalah is that I would say our general view of the world, when we think of the world in our physical view of the world, even if it involves very advanced scientific knowledge about the world, is to a great degree a partial reality. Kabbalah, the way we look at the world in Kabbalah is, I would say, a complete reality, meaning not only taking into account the physical world, but also taking into account the spiritual world. And I'll give you an analogy for this. When we look at the physical world, right, if we look at the world, so a lot of people have a very narrow understanding of that. The truth is, what we can see with our eyes of the universe is a, I mean, you know what percentage of the universe it is? I mean, it's 0.00000001% of the universe is what we can see with our eyes. We can see almost nothing with our eyes. Even if you go out of the city, go out to the Catskills this Labor Day weekend, Hudson Valley Resort with Gateways, and you look up and there are no clouds and there's no artificial light, very little artificial light and very little smog, and you look up there, you'll see a few thousand stars. But there are millions, tens of billions of stars, right? You can't even see all the planets. Heck, we didn't even know there were some planets till about 3 months ago, right? I mean, you know, we all thought Pluto was it, right? But now Pluto's not sure if it's a planet. Maybe it is. It's 700 kilometers. We've got enough mass and gravity to turn to a sphere. Maybe it's a planet. Maybe it's a Pluton. Maybe it's a comet. Maybe it's part of the asteroid belt. Who knows? Whatever, right? But basically, our understanding of the universe, when you expand it out, is almost zero, right? And the same is true when we look into the universe, in the inner verse. We start looking, oh yes, I will look at the world and go deeper and deeper. What we see is that the world that we see with our senses really is a very superficial picture, which is probably not even true. Right? What we see as, with our eyes, a smooth surface on a microscopic level, and no offence to the shul here, is probably pitted with craters and valleys and stuff like that, because, you know, I only, very, very superficial level. If I looked at the microscope, I'd probably find a lot of flaws in that. And if you looked at the electron microscope, you'd see a totally different picture than what we see with our eyes, or with a regular microscope. And actually, the deepest level of each world is the most superficial level of the next world. The deepest level I can go with my eyes is the most superficial level of the microscopic world. The deepest level of the microscopic world is the most superficial level of the electron microscope world. And so on and so forth. And by the way, as Rav Chaim Volozhin points out, the same is true of the spiritual world. Right? We have many different levels of spirituality. The deepest level of spirituality here is the most superficial level of the next spiritual world. And if you like to think of it in terms of that physical analogy, as I said, we have to talk in physical analogies because we are beings who are physical. We always relate through our experience. I can't talk to you about things which are totally spiritual because, as a physical being, all I can talk about is relating through the physical body. It's type of like, as for example, little kids do this very, very much so. In other words, they'll look at something which they've not experienced and they'll have to put it into something in their very narrow 3-4 years of experience in life, which when they're confronted with something totally different is a little, you know, a little difficult for them. I remember once I was living in Toronto, bought a swing set for the kids, and I brought it home. It was on the roof rack of the van. It's a huge flat square cardboard box that basically takes up the entire roof rack of the car. One of my kids, Shmuley, who's now 15, then he was, I think, 3, looks up at this thing, and I'm taking it off the roof of the car, and he says, kids always ask you questions at those moments, right? Yeah, the hernia is just about to pop out, the back is about to give way, and he asks you, Abba, can we do whatever, you know, that type of thing. So he says, Abba, and I say, yeah, what do you want? Right? And he says, big pizza. Because you see, in his experience, if it's in a flat, square cardboard box, what is it? It's a pizza. If it happens to take up the entire roof rack of my car, then it must be a big pizza. Okay. So we are like my son when it comes to many spiritual ideas. We imagine that, oh, it's a big, oh, yeah, I've had that. You mean it's like a big pizza, right? You see, that's why it's always sod, right? So I am using physical analogies here. I'm talking about what we see and expanding out beyond that. I'm talking about what we see with our senses. And in truth, the word in Hebrew for olam, the word for world or our physical existence is olam. Olam is the word for concealment in Hebrew. He'elem, ayin lamed mem, the root ayin lamed mem means concealment. Because our world is a world of concealment. And it's interesting. The Sefer Yetzirah, the book of creation, says that our world, it quotes a verse. It says, Ashan le'enayim. What's Ashan? Smoke. It's like smoke in front of the eyes. And the Sefer Yetzirah, the book of creation, says, what do you mean by smoke? Ashan. It says, Ashan is an acronym, Roshei Tevot, an acronym for three words, Olam Shana Nefesh. Ashan is smoke, and it stands for Olam Shana Nefesh. What does Olam Shana Nefesh mean? Olam means space, Shana means time, Nefesh means self or ego. In other words, what is the smoke screen that prevents us from seeing the true reality? What's the Ashan, the smoke? Olam, space, Shana, time, Nefesh, ego. In other words, we are always trapped, in a sense, within the smoke screen, Ashan le'enayim, smoke to the eyes of Olam Shana Nefesh, space, time, soul. And so the world, in fact, concealment. And do we actually know, and this is a question the Kabbalists discuss, when we look at the world, do we really know what is reality and what is illusion? Very often, we might look at something and not have a clue what it is, because we only see a part of that reality. When we see the entire reality, we will say, aha, now I know that this is the reality. I will then look at it and say, this is what I have seen as reality, is in fact the totality of reality. We then find out at the next stage that it's not even real. Right? And we might even look a little deeper and find out that what we thought was real was really part of another level of reality, which is also not real. And the deeper we go, the more we find that actually what we thought was reality again is really just part of a far greater reality. And the truth is, you can go on for a long time defining what is reality and not knowing what it is. All right, so what the Kabbalah wants to do for us is to try to reveal to us what is the true reality. So do we see the total or the deeper reality, or are we only looking at the world in the sense of a partial reality? There was a great poet called Ogden Nash. I'm sure you've all heard of him, a very famous American poet, Ogden Nash. Ogden Nash said that, a certain interesting idea, he said that you can look at a drop of water and you can know that that drop of water is a human tear. You can figure out how much salt is in it, you can figure out how much protein there is in it, you can figure out how much hair there is in it, and so on and so forth, mascara, the rest, right? However, the one thing you cannot know is, was it a tear of joy, or was it a tear of sadness? Was it a tear of separation, or was it a tear of friendship? Was it a tear of anger, or was it a tear of happiness? Right? And he says, that is the essence of that drop of water. Is the essence of that drop of water how much salt is in it? Is the essence of that drop of water the protein content? Is the essence of the soap water how much mascara dissolved? Or is the essence of that drop of water the human feeling and emotion that that represents? I would say that if you're only looking at the amount of salt in it, you've only looked at the surface, you haven't scratched the surface. And so Torah and Judaism as a whole wants us to look at things in terms of their essence, in terms of their purpose, and not in terms of the external reality. For example, the Hebrew word for face is panim. Panim is the Hebrew word for face. I don't have this. The reason it's in English, I'm sorry, not Hebrew, because sometimes I just take a little USB and I play this in someone else's notebook, and very often they don't have Hebrew fonts, right? It's not because I, you know, but I'm sure you're familiar with the Hebrew. Pei nun yud mem. Panim is face. Now, it's interesting in Hebrew. In Israel, if you go to Misrad Ha Hey Nun Yud Mem, are you going to the Ministry of Faces? No, some people call it Ministry Misrad Al Hapanim. That could be right. However, right, are you going to the Ministry of Faces, or are you going to the Ministry of Panim? What's Panim mean? Yeah. Interior. The Ministry of the Interior is called Misrad Panim, and the face is called Panim. Now, it's interesting if you contrast that with the English word for face. The English word for face is based on the Greek and Latin roots, which are, for example, facade, surface, superficial, on the face of things. What does that tell you? What that tells me is, you see, from the Jewish perspective, you know what the face is there for? To reveal what's inside. Isn't that what the face does? The face reveals what is inside, right? Obviously, I mean, not always, depends how much Botox, right, and liposuction and mascara and all that type of stuff. It may not reveal what's inside, it may conceal what's inside. Right, but ideally, the face, the panim, is meant to reveal the pnim, the inner essence of the person, and it does that. That's why the Talmud says you are not allowed to look into the face of an evil person, because you are looking into evil. You can see evil on the face. I have a picture at home. Actually, I should have put it here, but I didn't. I have a picture at home of three elderly Jews in Yemen from about 80 years ago, sitting around a Talmud study. They're 80 years old. By the standards of Gentleman's Quarterly, GQ, and the standards of People and Us and other rags, right, they are not beautiful people. They're definitely not beautiful people. I mean, they need a shave, right, they need a haircut, they need some Armani suit. I mean, but you know what? You look at their faces, they are beautiful. You can see a glow of joy on their faces as they're learning Torah. These men who are probably in their 70s and 80s, they're beautiful faces. Beauty is the inside, nim, and that's the essence of what we mean. I remember, and very often we conceal, if we only focus on the external. I mentioned this story, I don't know if it's this group, but when I was a rabbi in Toronto, I went to a bookstore, Borders Books, and there was a bargain table. Always certain books get condemned to the bargain table as soon as they're published. You know that? Right, the publisher takes them straight from the publishing press and puts them on the bargain table. Okay, thank God it did not happen to my book again. Right, but one of those books, I mean, there are a few books, like Great Trains of 1820s, right, is always on the bargain table. Ethiopian cuisine on the bargain table. French military tactics on the bargain table, etc. Right? So, the French anti-terrorism, source book, whatever. Right, so one of the books on the bargain table is Grey's Anatomy. Because Grey's Anatomy is boring for most people. Grey's Anatomy is a thick book which has got cutaway diagrams of the human body. I mentioned the story, I don't know if anyone was at the group, but I couldn't resist buying the book because it was thick, that thick, hundreds of pages, and it was only $4.99 Canadian, which is nothing. Right. So basically, I felt that it was prohibited for me not to buy the book. What we call Bal Tashchit, last week's Torah portion, do not destroy its trees. No wanton destruction. Right, so I felt that not buying it was a tragedy. So anyway, I bought it. I'm reading the stuff about the face. I'm sitting in my office. The secretary, the human face, cut open diagram, the bone structure, the muscles. Secretary phones, she says, Rabbi, someone here to see you has an appointment. I said, okay, fine. Put away the Grey's Anatomy, take out my Talmud. And this guy walks in, and as he walks in, sits down opposite me, I look at his face. Totally focused on this guy's face, stripping away the skin, looking at the muscles, the bone structure, the fat, as he's talking, looking at the epiglottis movement. I mean, it's like fascinating. I'm looking at this guy, he's thinking, the rabbi's really focused today. He's taken some, must have taken some Ritalin with his Prozac this morning. Try combinations, interesting. Ritalin, Prozac, Nexium, Lipitor, milkshake. Right, wow. Alka-Seltzer, wash down the Alka-Seltzer. Anyway, so, a lot of businessmen do this every day. So anyway, I'm looking at him and I notice a click in his jaw as he's talking. And I think, I wonder what that is. Right, and after 10 minutes he looks at me, his tears in his eyes, I look at the tear ducts, I'm wondering. And he says, what do you think I should do? And I'm thinking to myself, what the hell are you asking me for? Go to a plastic surgeon. Right? Go click in your jaw, buddy. Don't ask a rabbi. Right? Go to a doctor. Right? But you see, the problem was I was so focused on the surface, facade, superficial, face, that I missed the pnim, which is the inner self. What Kabbalah wants us to do is to look at life and to look at the world and to look a little deeper. Right? And indeed, the Ramban, Nachmanides, says this was the major argument, interestingly enough, between the Jews and the Greeks, the Jews and the Hellenists. Because he used to say, we are not like that Greek, he refers to Aristotle and his students, who only admit to that which their eyes see and only believe in what the intellect understands. The Greek way of looking at the world, which I would say much of the Western world has adopted and enslaved themselves to, the Greek way of looking at the world is what I can see is real. What I can't see is not real. What I can touch, it's real. If I can't touch it, it's not real. I understand it, it's true. I don't understand it, it's not true. I have an understanding, I believe, that one of the reasons, and Stephen Jay Gould points out something like this, that the Greek statues of philosophers, they never had head coverings. Interestingly enough. And Maimonides tells us, and actually it's in the Talmud, Maimonides says in Guide for the Perplexed, he says, Chachamim Arishonim, our early sages, Hayu Soladim Megilui Rosh, would be repelled by the bare head. They couldn't, it was like repulsive to them, they couldn't take it. What's the difference? Why is it Greek philosophers quite comfortable walking around without a hat? Right? And Jewish scholars not comfortable unless the head's covered. What's the reason? I think the reason is, maybe, I don't know if it's a stretch, but I think the reason may be because in Greek tradition, there is nothing beyond my brain. There is no level, there's no cap, there's no glass ceiling, there's nothing beyond my brain, my mind, the mind of Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, etc., Hippocrates, etc., right? The mind of the philosopher, the mind of the human being, that determines reality, that determines what there is. In Jewish tradition, we say there is a cap, limitation. Limitation. My mind is not the be-all and end-all. I remember I had a doctor in Australia when I was a kid. And this doctor was an interesting man. He was a religious man. He was a Christian, a believer in God. And at the time, when I was a kid, it was very common to take tonsils out. I mean, you used to have a cough, right? The next thing you know, there'd be some doctor with a switchblade. Oh, right, you know, you'd be in the hospital having jello, big compensation, right? So anyway, so this was a very common thing. I mean, today it's not that common to have your tonsils out. You know, I mean, I'm sure most people here probably have not had their tonsils out, but, right? Probably, my luck, probably in Queens, 90% of doctors take tonsils out every second day. But no, most people here probably have. Okay. And this doctor said to me, he says, you know what, he says, I have some throat problems, he says, I'm not going to take your tonsils out. And I said, oh, thank you. And he said, you know why? I said, I don't really care why, it's fine. And he says, no, let me explain. I said, fine. So he says, because the reason we are quick to take tonsils out is because it goes like this. The argument goes like this. We don't know what the purpose of tonsils are. Therefore, they have no purpose. Therefore, if you've got a throat problem, let's get rid of them. He says, therefore, I don't like. You know what I mean? I don't think that therefore is a logical connection. I don't know the purpose, therefore, there's no purpose. He said, where do you get that therefore? The chutzpah. He didn't say chutzpah, he couldn't have pronounced it. Right? But where do you get the chutzpah? The arrogance to say, therefore, there's no purpose. There was an old Israeli joke from the Ottoman Turkish period. Not funny. Warning. Joke is not funny. Okay? Right? There is an old joke from the Ottoman period. There was a Turkish captain who was sent in a boat to go, a ship, to go from, I forgot where he was, to go to Cyprus, to Malta. The Isle of Malta in the Mediterranean. And there was terrible weather, lots of clouds and fog. He didn't have radar. This is the First World War period, before the First World War. He didn't succeed in finding Malta. He comes back to base, and the commander says, what happened? He says, sorry to report, sir, Malta does not exist. I didn't find it, therefore, it does not exist. Does that not sound like much of the Western world? I can't find it, therefore it doesn't exist. Well, I haven't seen the soul. There was a famous physician who once said, an idiot, who once said, I've dissected hundreds of bodies, done autopsies on hundreds of bodies, never once have I found a soul. But what did he expect? What did he expect? Right? Something labeled soul, Grey's Anatomy, soul, right? Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, Chaya, Echid, I'd say all the 10 levels of the soul, labeled, yeah.
Didn't the Soviets say that after they went to space, they said they've been to space and there was no God?
Right, interesting. It's a similar, exactly, a very similar idea. It's kind of interesting because when the first Americans went to space, Neil Armstrong, for example, he saw the Earth, he read from Genesis. He read from Genesis. And all the American, and the truth is, my bet is that Yuri Gagarin, had he not had the KGB standing there like that with him, probably would have said, I believe in God. Right? But obviously, it was not a free speech society, not possible to know what he really felt. Right? In any case, that is how Nachmanides, the Ramban, typifies the debate between the Jews and the Greeks. Now, Kabbalah, we would say, first of all, is an integral part of the Jewish oral tradition, what we call the Torah, Shebaal Peh, transmitted by God to Moses on Mount Sinai, not a separate body of knowledge, but part of the totality of Torah. Just as, for example, God gives Moses a verse in the Torah, says, write this down. But then, in addition, God also gave him instructions of how that verse is to be brought into action. How is it to be brought into action? Right? And, of course, that's called the Oral Torah. That was eventually written down in the form of the Mishnah. Right? He then gave him, not only that, but he gave him also the oral tradition of what it means on a spiritual level. That was written down in the form of the Zohar around the same time as the Mishnah was written down by the students of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. It is referred to by scholars throughout Jewish history. And indeed, much of the Kabbalah was written in the Zohar, but not all of it, because much of it still remained oral. It is explained and elucidated some of the greatest Kabbalists. I'm sure you've heard of some of them. Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, the Arizal, Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, the Arizal, lived in Sfat, as did many great Kabbalists. Anyone who's been to Sfat will understand why immediately, right? And you go to Sfat, the air there, the mountains, it's just, it's unbelievable, right? It's a place where you feel elevated just by walking in there. So the Arizal Rabbi Zaluria, Chaim Vital, one of his students, by the way, was a man by the name of Alkavetz, or Shlomo Alkavetz, who was a great Kabbalist. He was also a great musician, and he composed a very famous song, I'm sure you all know it, L'Chadodi. Composed by Rosh Shlomo Alkavetz, right? Reb Chaim Vital, the Gaon of Vilna, Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi, Reb Moshe Chaim Lozato, the Reb Moshe Cordovero, the Maharal, Reb Yehuda Lerva of Prague, pretty much spanning the gamut, as you see, the Gaon of Vilna was not Hasidic. Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi was very Hasidic, right? And then you have Reb Chaim Vital, right? Sfardi, Reb Moshe Chaim Lozato, Sfardi from Italy, Maharal from Prague, right? Reb Isaac Luria from Egypt, right? I mean, they had a whole range. Ashkenaz, Sfard, Italy, right, Lithuania, etc. All these great people all studied and explained the Zohar. It's type of interesting because there were a group of scholars, amongst them a famous Hebrew University scholar by the name of Gershom Scholem, who maintained that the Zohar was actually invented by the person who published it in the 1300s by the name of Moshe de Leon. So Moshe de Leon published it in the 13th century, and according to Gershom Scholem, it was created by him. He made it up. Of course, what this doesn't explain is the fact, you see, rabbis generally don't tend to be too into accepting new books of the Torah. You know what I mean? If someone would come here and say, listen, I don't know the rabbi this synagogue is, but to say, Rabbi so-and-so, do you know we just discovered the sixth book of the Torah? So you'll have to like add some parchments on. I mean, what do you think his reaction to that would be? Oh, no problem. Give me a break, right? And yet, all these great rabbis, in the history, there was a very little noise when the Zohar was published. Why was there so? There was some criticism, and there were some rabbis maintained that certain verses were from later sources, and that may be. But the bulk of it was accepted. Why? Because it was part of their tradition already. It just had not yet been published. Now, I'd like to look at what are the four major areas of study of the Kabbalah. Number one is what we call Ma'aseh Bereshit, which literally means the deeds of creation. That talks about the infinite God creating a finite world. In other words, this actually, generally, your average person, when asked about what is the religious view of creation, will say the Latin creatio ex nihilo, which in Hebrew is bria yesh me'ayin. What does that mean? It means something from nothing. God created something from nothing, right? That's the standard way we look at it. The Kabbalists would say that's actually wrong. It's the opposite of the truth. It's not something from nothing. They say the following. The world is finite and frail and not an absolute existence. Compared to God, the world's nothing. God is infinite and absolute and the only absolute true thing, which means God is something. So what did God create? He created nothing from something. He created something from nothing. God created nothing from something. In other words, the main problem of creation is how God created a world which is pathetic and nothing, which somehow conceals his absolute, essential, true reality, which is everything. The problem of creation is not something from nothing. That's no big deal for God to create. Right? The problem of creation is God creates a world where we don't see the true reality of God. He created, conceals what we call tzimtzum, which means concealment. Or contraction, so to speak, that in a sense God created a space for the world to exist so that we could live and have free will and exist as though we are independent beings, even though we're not. But in order to do that, he had to conceal his true essence within that smokescreen of Olam, Shana, Nefesh, space, time, and soul. And he did that successfully so that we can go through life, and there are people who can go through life, in a total concealment, totally blinded by all this, and never once find the truth. But he created it in such a way that you can find that truth, you can perceive it, you can confront it, and you can find it. And that is, of course, through the Torah. So we have the idea of Maaseh Bereshit, the deeds of creation, is this concept of creation of nothing from something, the idea of God's concealment of the world. In fact, I have here God, one of the names of God, of Hashem, is called Ha-Makom. When you comfort a mourner, you say, Hamakom Yenachem. That means, may God comfort you. Now, it's interesting, the word Hamakom means what? The place. Why do we call God the place? Isn't that a strange name for God? You know, there are many names, the merciful, the infinite, the place. So Rukhaim of Volozhin, a student of the Gaon of Vilna, explains, what a great Kabbalist, he explains in the following way. It's a very simple but beautiful idea. He says, you see, everything needs a framework of existence. Everything, this lectern needs dimensions, right, of space, and it needs time in which to exist. The dimension of space-time in which it exists is what we call makom. Is this clear so far? Very simple, right? For this to exist, it needs makom. Ein lecha davar she'ein lo makom, as the Talmud says, there's nothing which doesn't have a place, because everything needs a place, couldn't exist. If it had no space and time, couldn't exist. So let me up now. Space and time themselves are physical creations. What is the framework in which they exist? If nothing physical can exist without something giving it existence, what gives space-time existence? What is the answer to that? God. As the way the Midrash puts it, Hu mekomo shel olam. He is the place of the world. Ve'ein ha'olam mekomo. The world is not his place. Meaning, God doesn't need the world in order to exist. I need space and time in order to exist. And food. Lots of it. Right, and chocolate, very essential. Right, so I need space, time, chocolate, the essential dimensions of life in order to exist. Right, the world needs space and time to exist. What does God need to exist? The answer is nothing. The world needs God to exist. So in a sense, you could say that God exists where? Within the, or rather the world exists within God. Space and time exist within God. So that's why he's called Ha. Makom, which means the ultimate place. The ultimate place. Is this clear so far? The next section is what we call Maaseh Merkava, which means deeds of a chariot. What's a chariot? A chariot, in ancient times, a chariot would be something which the commander of the battle would ride on the chariot and be protected from the battlefield, theoretically, right? And he'd be able to affect the battle without being affected by it. He'd be able to influence what's going on without being hurt or affected. That's what a merkava is. That's what it's that which allows someone to ride. Or it was also used in a procession, right? You would know who is the king, the one riding on the chariot at the head of that procession, right? So it was an elevator. It's something which proclaims the glory of the person riding it, and also it is that which communicates. Through that, he communicates his plans to the battlefield without being affected by it. So we talk about Maaseh Merkava. One of the ideas there is it talks about God's divine providence, what we call Hashkacha Pratit, God's providence or control of the world. You see, he affects the world, but he's not affected by it. In fact, God gives the world over, interestingly enough, into the hands of the human being. The way the Kabbalists look at it, and they talk here about divine providence, God's interaction with the world, reincarnation, suffering, human free will, and they talk about the idea that God gave over the running of the world into the hands of the human being. Meaning, he placed the reins of the chariot in our hands. Jacob, Yaakov, had a dream. He dreams of a ladder going connecting heaven and earth. And on the ladder are angels going up and down. And the commentaries ask, angels should be going down then up, not up and then down. If you dreamed of angels, right? Then you'd imagine they'd be coming down from heaven, then going up. Change the shift, punch the card, right, go that right. But they come down, then go up. Why are angels going up, then coming down? Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, great Italian Kabbalist, says the following. Angels going up and down means the angels or the spiritual energy that we create through our actions is what's called an angel. We can create positive or negative. And he says they go up the ladder. And God sends down in turn an equivalent force to the angel that we created, he sends down the ladder. So if I create a good force that goes up the ladder, what comes down is a positive force into this world. If I create something bad, negative, God forbid, what goes up the ladder, that goes up the ladder. Guess what comes down? The equivalent. So actually the power of the theologians, he says, how can you define an act of God? Why is that an act of God, not something else? And then, you know, they brought priests and rabbis and imams and everyone said, yeah, he's right. I mean, everything's an act of God. And so the insurance company is like going out of their mind because, you know, half insurance is dependent upon this clause, act of God. Right? But the Kabbalists would say everything. The truth is, the sustenance of the entire world is an act of God. However, what happens within the bubble, within the world, so to speak, it's almost like a closed environment in which, yes, the energy that keeps it running comes from God. But what happens within is, to a great degree, the bulk of what happens within is affected by the actions of the human being who is created in the image of God. Just as God is a creator, we are creators. Just as God has his will, and he can will, and so it becomes, so also the human being is like that. That's the second part. Tamei ha-mitzvot, which means reasons for the commandments. That is to say, how the physical and spiritual, the body and the soul, affect and relate to each other. How the mitzvot of the Torah are the key to maintaining certain spiritual harmony. So, for example, two examples of that is not mixing meat and milk together. Right? Why don't we mix meat and milk together? The Torah says, the reason we don't is the Torah says not to. What's one of the ideas behind it? The Kabbalists say is because meat and milk represent two different worlds. One represents the world of din, and one which represents the world of chesed. Din means justice, contraction, taking. Chesed means kindness, expansion, and giving. Because you see, milk requires that the animal be alive in order to provide milk. To milk an animal, it has to be alive. And indeed, the milk that the mother gives is the ultimate kindness which she's giving of herself to the child. In English, it's an expression of the milk of human kindness. Right? Because milk symbolizes chesed. Meat, the animal's got to be dead to provide meat. You've got to take away life to provide meat. You've got to kill. It's din, what we call din or justice. Right? Now, when you cook something in something else, so to speak, what is the... If you cook a kid in its mother's milk, you cook meat in milk, what's the main thing and what's serving it? The main ingredient is the meat. What is the servant of the meat, to give a little taste to it, is the milk. So you are making chesed, kindness, subservient to din, to justice. It should be the other way around. But ideally, we are supposed to imitate God in his midat ha-chesed, in his attribute of kindness and giving. And we are supposed to be focused on that. To put it the other way around is disturbing that type of harmony, where ideally, as the Talmud says, if you're a teacher or a parent, it says, la'olam, always, tehei yamin mekarevet u'smol docheh. Draw close with the right and push away with the left. Because you see, the left is the weaker, the right is the stronger. And right is symbolizes chesed, kindness. Left is din. So which means, if you are pushing away the left, pulling close with the right, what? Calculate the vectors, folks, right? The sum total will be towards you. Chesed. Because it's the right, which is the stronger, is drawing towards. Which means, that's got to be the dominant force. That's got to be the dominant force, not the din symbolized by meat. Linen and wool, to a certain degree, right, symbolizes also ideas that we are told that actually the Kabbalists tell us that Cain and Abel, Cain and Hevel, Cain and Abel, that first murder ever, right, Hevel, it says, brought of his sheep, of his flocks, brought wool. Cain brought from his crops, which he brought flax, linen. Which one brought which? Right? We are told, if you look there, at the very beginning, here we go. It says this, Cain brought, he brought from flax. Flax, which is linen. Linen is from flax plant. He brought from Priha Adama. And Hevel, Hevi Gamhu, Hevel also brought from his sheep. He brought wool. Brought from his sheep. So the Kabbalists say what they each brought was... Now it's interesting, the word Cain, what does Cain mean? It comes from the Hebrew word koneh, which means to acquire. To acquire. What does Hevel mean? Nothing. Hevel havalim amar kohelet hakol Hevel. Nothing. Vanity of vanities. And it's interesting, it says Hevel hevi gamhu. He also brought. In other words, they represent two extremes of the human character. One extreme, which is Cain, is the person who is totally the get-up-and-go acquisition, right? Aggressive, me, right? I will do, I will act, I will not receive from anyone, I will do, right? Very aggressive, very acquisition-like, very kinyan. Right? On the other hand, Hevel represents another extreme, which is also not. Now, that extreme is good. It's good to be. It's good to want to build yourself up, to build the world up. It's good to want to do stuff. But the negative side of it is that if you ultimately say that I am it, I am the builder, then guess what? I'm also the destroyer. I can decide that you live. I can decide the opposite, which is what he actually did. It's a very negative side. Hevel was nothing. What does that mean? He didn't look at himself as anything. He looked at himself as a complete nothing, which means he wasn't motivated to do anything. The only reason he fought is because Gam who he also fought. So Hevel represents nothingness. Right? Nothingness. But that's also negative. You may say, oh, it's good to be humble. Yeah, it's good to be humble. But it's not good to say, I cannot do anything. I'm useless. That's not good, is it? Both extremes are negative. Okay? To take both extremes, right, to tie them together is not good. You've got to take, you've got to, so to speak, have an understanding that sometimes you need the Cain, sometimes you need the Hevel. Sometimes you need a humility, and sometimes you need the independence. Right? And but the intertwining of the two together, not doing that, is a way of reminding us to keep those worlds and to keep those in correct balance. Keep in correct balance. The linen and the wool. So we have certain ideas of explanation of commandments. We also have, and just to give you one more example of that, shoes. Right, shoes are mentioned in the Torah quite a few times, right? Where are shoes mentioned in the Torah? So, yeah? Right? Moses comes to the burning bush. God says, Shal na'alecha na'areka, take off your shoes. Joshua speaks to the angel. The angel says, take off your shoes. The priests, the Kohanim, go into the temple. What does it say? No shoes. Okay, Yom Kippur, coming up soon. What do we do? No shoes, no leather shoes. So, and another case is a man, two brothers. One brother is married. He dies without children. It's a mitzvah for his surviving brother to marry the widow. Right? What if he doesn't want to? What if he says, I always thought my brother was an idiot for marrying her anyway. I should now answer. So he doesn't want to do this. So guess what? His shoe gets taken off. Strange thing. What's the shoe? So one of our great Kabbalists, Rav Chaim of Volozhin, quoting also from the Malbim, says the following. He says, think of it in the following way. The relationship of the body to the soul and the relationship of the shoe to the body. Think of those. The relationship of the body, what does the body do for the soul? He says the soul is this elevated spiritual thing. It cannot have contact with this world. For the soul to be able to act in this world, to walk in this world, to work in this world and to walk in this world, you know what it requires? The body. Right? The body, so to speak, protects and allows the lowest level of the soul contact with this world. Which is exactly what the shoe does for the body. Make myself clear? What the shoe does for the body does for the soul. One of the ways that the Torah expresses the word for body in Hebrew is shoe. A shoe is actually the body. So when Moses comes and he has a level of prophecy that no one has ever had before, right, the highest level of prophecy is hitpashtut hagashmiut, elevation beyond the physical, God tells him, take off your shoe. Relate to me on the spiritual level. The priest, the Kohen, goes into the temple, the Kohen comes up here, gives you a bracha, a blessing, takes off his shoe. Right? It's a way of saying, elevate yourself above the material. Okay? Yom Kippur, one day a year, we totally ignore our physical self. We ignore the body. We don't eat, we don't drink, we don't wash. Ignore the body. What do we also do? Remove our shoes. Right? A person who is mourning, certain sitting shiva, doesn't wear leather shoes either. Because we want to give them the lesson that, you know what? That person is not gone. They've moved to a different dimension. They've taken off their shoes. The body has gone, the soul still lives. Okay, and indeed the brother who does not want to marry the widow, right, you see, the widow is the closest person spiritually to the deceased man. And the closest person physically is the brother. The closest person physically and the closest person spiritually, if they have a child, that child will be the ideal shoe for the soul of the deceased brother. And if he refuses to do that, he is called that he doesn't deserve his own shoe in his own body. So that's what the shoe... Why leather? Why leather? Because a leather shoe was once a body. Nylon was never a body. Canvas was never a body. Leather was once a body. And so that's the idea, how the Kabbalists understand the idea. I mean, obviously, there's a lot more detail in that. I'm just giving a very... Yeah?
Sorry. The younger brother, he gets married to a woman. Only if he's not married himself, or if he's married already?
It's a technical. I mean, generally, today we don't do it at all, right? For various technical reasons, right? But in ancient times, even if he was married, he would have to marry the widow, right? So the idea of the shoe, therefore, is I just wanted to focus on that again. When the Kabbalist sees the word shoe, what does the Kabbalist see? The body, right? And therefore, when they look at those mitzvot, it's a very different way of looking at it. Okay. What is the purpose of the study of Kabbalah? Sorry? What's the purpose of the study of Kabbalah? I would say there are... What? I did? Oh, okay, sorry. Oh, D. I'm sorry. Yes, I did. I skipped D. Mystical explanations of verses, stories, and incidents in the Tanakh. Yes. That's an essential part of the Kabbalah. Is a different way... Now, of course, the shoe idea, of course, could fit under D as well as C. But let me give you the example here. Abraham's donkey... Because the Torah tells us that Abraham, you know, he took Isaac to sacrifice Isaac on a donkey, right? Familiar with that? And it says that Moses, when he went to Egypt, took his family, his wife and kids, to Egypt on the donkey. And it says in Zechariah that the Messiah will come on a donkey. So Rashi says, the middle donkey, where it says Moses took his wife and children to Egypt on Vayakivem al Hachamor. He put them on the donkey. Now what does the donkey mean? As opposed to a donkey, right? It means a specific donkey. So Rashi tells us, of course, it's a specific donkey. It's the same donkey that Abraham used. And it's the same donkey that Messiah will use. So you have a donkey that Abraham uses in the year 2000, right? Jewish year 2000. Then 448 years later, Moses uses the same donkey. And then approximately 4,000 years later, the Messiah comes on the same donkey. What, God's never heard of leasing? The same donkey? 50 billion miles? Well, what's the idea? Now, granted, right, it's possible for God to do a miracle and make a donkey live for thousands of years. Of course, it's not impossible, but why would he do such a thing? Strange type of miracle. It's a big deal with the donkey. The answer, the Kabbalists say, is donkey doesn't mean donkey. Yes, on the simple reading of the verse, that's what it means. But you know what it really means? It means chamor, donkey, really means chomer. What does chomer mean? The materialism. The material. Everyone has a donkey within. In other words, I've got my brain and my soul is riding the donkey. Right? The donkey is, you know, better like, eat. You know, that's the donkey. Right? Who's guiding the donkey? Am I riding the donkey or is the donkey telling me where to go? Right? Is it not, am I like, you know, it's like, that's it? Right? Or am I in control? That's the question. Abraham rode, you know what riding does? Riding controls and directs. Abraham rides the donkey. He shows the world that it's possible to control and to direct the human being. We are not animals. It's possible to derive, it's possible to control and direct us. Moses, Moshe, brings down the Torah, gives us the exact directions of how to do that. The Mashiach ultimately will bring us to a level where the donkey intuitively wants to go where the soul wants to go. Same place, right? And so therefore, that's what donkey means, and that's the letters are actually the same. Now, what is the purpose of studying these things? I think there's a few reasons. A, to internalize our belief in God and to strengthen our belief. The more you see Hashem's wisdom, the more we see and answer the major questions of life. Why there is a world, how divine providence works, what is the Torah about? What are we here for? Then obviously, the deeper we can internalize that belief, the better people we can be. To inspire good actions. If the Kabbalah inspires you just to light an aromatherapy candle, right, or to wear a red thread, that is not it. Right? It's supposed to inspire you to do good actions because if we see the power of the individual and our connection to all the different worlds of spirituality and the power we have of the angels that go up and then the angels that come down, and we control that, that should inspire me and tell me to make great care in what I do and what I don't do. Inspire me to actions and inspire me to mitzvot. And finally, to understand ourselves, our purpose, our relationship with God and each other, God's relationship with the world, the more I know about this, the more effective I will be in positively affecting the outcome of all of these actions. That's a little bit of an introduction to Kabbalah. Obviously, no one's a Kabbalist at this point. Don't change your name or anything, get a tattoo. Right? This is just a little bit of an introduction to what Kabbalah is about. And the rest is commentary. Go and learn. Thank you very much for coming.